TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I've got to tell you, I've never been more glad that we're both well over age 25.
The Borg are back in town, the Borg are back in town, Borg are back in town.
I don't think everyone down on the surface of Earth is as excited about that as you seem to be right now, Matthew.
That's going to be the number one hit on the radio when the Borg take over. So,
well, it is. Yeah, after assimilation of the planet, it's definitely going to be number one. And it's going to break all records because it's going to forever be number one on the Billboard charts.
Instead of, you know, being, they got to keep them separated. It's you got to be assimilated.
Oh, we could keep going with this.
Yes, we could. I'm sorry. I will stop now.
All right. Yes, everyone. We're going to be talking about the ninth part of Star Trek Picard Season 3 today. This is Vox. And Matthew, it was interesting to see, well, a few things. My speculation last week about what may have happened in The Best of Both Worlds turned out to be exactly what happened. We have ended up with a Borg story where you and I were really hoping that that's not where it was going to go, although over the past couple of episodes, it seemed more and more likely. How are you feeling about it? And is it as straightforward as you had feared? Does there seem to be a twist to it still to come that you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, my first reaction to watching the episode, you know, I stay up to watch the episodes. They start around 11-ish where I am. And my thought was, oh, well, it's the Borg. Okay, so we went there. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't necessarily happy with that thought. And then, you know, as the episode kind of played out, and I think some of the connections that they made to even things that we've seen on things like First Contact and beyond, mm-hmm, were interesting. And then rewatching it a couple of times and, you know, hearing from Metallus this idea that the show's always been about legacy and therefore,
yeah,
you know, have to go with a villain, you know, that means something to this cast and this crew. And mm-hmm, so I get that completely. And I think what we've done here is to create an opportunity to, you know, every single season of Picard has dealt with the Borg in some way. And I think the greatest disadvantage that this season has is that's the case.
Yeah.
And that the seasons were not, really well mapped out. In some ways, I think we've mentioned, maybe I've mentioned it, it's a little bit like Star Wars sequel trilogy syndrome, right? Where, mm-hmm, you know, there wasn't really a plan going in, and we've kind of come to this end. But all that said, I think that this is a place where, okay, we're going to finally put the Borg to bed, because mm-hmm, Picard and his crew here are going to deal with them once and for all. And then the mm-hmm only Borg we have left to explore would be Jurati's Borg. And, you know, that's an interesting place, yeah, to, I think, to be able to go. And they still exist, yeah, but in a different way. So,
well, you mentioned that and the fact that maybe this will finally be the end of the Borg. And we know that the title of the final episode is The Last Generation, bookending the first episode of the season called The Next Generation. However, I have a feeling that the word generation in the title, The Last Generation, does not refer to the Starfleet crews, that it refers instead to the Borg, because they will not be regenerating anymore, because this will be the end of them. So this is their last generation.
Well, and I would say, too, that, you know, but kind of before we get into the nitty-gritty there, if this mm-hmm was not the end of the Borg, it would be ridiculous, because the only reason to do this story is to give Jean-Luc Picard the finality of it being done and finished. Yeah, you know, right. I mean, I think it would also be a disservice to the story of Shaw that we get played out in this episode, and even Seven of Nine. And so I think, and the fact that, you know, the Borg have a big part, not only in the TNG cast, but in the Voyager series as well. And, you know, Batalis has even talked about that, the fact that the Borg Queen, we didn't see her face here, but Janeway had done a number on them. And so, again, this really seems to be bringing to a close the biggest, I mean, I guess, hanging thread from the 24th century, which is the Borg ever going to be taken care of in a way that they're done? We don't have to worry about them anymore. So,
yeah.
If you didn't do that, it would just be kind of dumb.
Yeah. Well, we have an idea of what the other side of the Borg Queen might look like, because it does seem that the face that we were seeing all season talking to Vadik is the Borg Queen. Metallus even said on Twitter that you saw the back of the face's head in this episode. But, you know, even last week when it seemed very likely to me that the Borg were going to be the resolution of the story, I figured the face is probably the Borg Queen communicating with Vadik because she needs Jack. So that's no surprise right there. I guess roll back for a moment here just so I can share my thoughts on the fact that it ends up being the Borg. I do totally agree with Metallus in that if you're going to give a send-off to the Next Generation crew, it makes the most sense to do so with a villain that has the most personal connection to them, to those characters. And certainly with the series being called Picard, of course, Picard, his relationship to the Borg Queen, all of this makes perfect sense. And it makes a story that is likely a lot more appealing to the general Star Trek audience than something like the Pah Wraiths. He has now said that the Pah Wraiths were never a consideration. I think that bringing the changelings into it, even if this wasn't their intention, if the Pah Wraiths were never a consideration, bringing the changelings into it was very effective in keeping people guessing throughout the season as to who the real villain was going to be, because you've got probably the second biggest villain in Star Trek after the Borg being the changelings in the Dominion. You've got so many visual references to things that could be related to the Pah Wraiths and the Fire Caves and all this stuff that it worked quite well, but it did start to fade towards the end, you know, episodes or parts 7 and 8, and then seems like the Borg. But I thought it was quite well done. I don't have any problem with them using the Borg. I was just hoping for a more interesting story because they seem to be weaving a more complex story than what this may end up being.
Right.
Because it feels like the conclusion here is probably going to be a lot more straightforward. I still want to know what's going on with the changeling Borg collaboration, so we can talk about that a little bit more as we go. But one thing that I often talk about, Larry and I talk about it a lot when we do the Ready Room, is how new Star Trek stories and series add texture to the Star Trek universe, and how when you watch something and then when you go back, I mean, you and I talked about this on this podcast last season about how the story of season 2 and Jean-Luc and his mother can really inform how you watch The Next Generation when you go back through it, because you see so many things in Jean-Luc's personality that have new meaning in light of that story. And this is a case where they are retconning the best of both worlds, but they're also giving us all new things to think about when we watch The Best of Both Worlds and everything that comes after.
First Contact did that too. So, you know, I mean, every time we do the Borg, we seem to be kind of like adding something that, oh, it was always there. Yeah. Pay no attention to the man behind the corner.
Right. Well, and this does that for First Contact even, because now we understand why Picard can hear the voices of the Borg.
Exactly.
Even though he had been removed and the Borg components that were in him had been removed after being assimilated as Lucutus. So, yeah, I think it's a fun story. It's yet another way the Borg are going to assimilate Earth. You and I were chatting about how... Okay, we're going to talk about the timeline in a minute, but initially, especially when you watch this the first time, the timeline doesn't necessarily seem to jive, and you have to really think about it a bit. And you told me, well, this is probably just one of the contingency plans that the Borg had. And I told you, yeah, they really like to cover their bases, like that failed attempt they made on Voyager, where they put nanoprobes into a shipment of Leola root in hopes of gradually assimilating exactly. the Voyager exactly. crew through Neelix's cooking. Mm-hmm. And that didn't work.
Yeah.
So luckily they had this other card up their sleeve with this whole, you know, aromatic syndrome thing.
Well, yeah, I think the thing about this is the fact that Jean-Luc had been implanted with a seed of new Borg organic tech that he would be able to pass on then to any prodigy that he had. Mm-hmm. And I think whether or not, you know, it had been Beverly's child with him, the thought process that one day Picard would have a child, I don't think is out of the realm of possibility. And
yeah, I still feel like it's a bit of a long shot. Initially, when I was thinking that this was their plan all along, I thought that's quite an assumption to make that he's going to have a kid and then decades will go by and then you'll be able to bring the kid back and then use him as the key master to assimilate Earth. But like you say, yeah, it's actually, as long as this was a contingency plan, one of many, it wasn't their only plan, right. then I think that it's fine and it works okay.
Well, and I think, you know, we were talking about this before we got into on the other side of the Titan, as we'll call it. The idea that Beverly hides Jack because she's fearful of Jack himself and growing up Jean-Luc Picard's son. And it is that fear that actually keeps the Borg from being able to act on this plan, I think, a lot sooner than they would have hoped they would have been able to. Yeah. And Beverly does a very good job here of hiding the fact that she was pregnant and, of course, keeping away from all of her friends. And by doing that, I think this is one of the things where I think the Borg would have been watching Jean-Luc to see what had happened with him.
Yeah, clearly that's what they've been doing. Yeah.
Exactly. But... Yeah. Again, Beverly's actions actually keep this from being able to come to fruition much earlier, because my guess is they wouldn't have needed, obviously, to wait for this person to grow up. You would not have wanted to wait that long, and it seems like even the earlier the better, you know, with the child. And so, again, the timeline is messed up for them because of the actions that Beverly had taken there. But then I think, you know, the genius of the idea that then Jack can be a transmitter for what the changelings have been able to introduce into the Starfleet system from Picard's DNA, which then would be able to propagate in every single person under 25, or at least, and put it this way, they make that statement here in the show. But it would be whenever that alien's frontal cortex or brain stops developing.
It wouldn't be across the board for every species, right? Yeah. Well, just quickly, you're talking about Beverly and how her fear hiding Jack away delayed the plans. Can you imagine what would have happened if Captain's Holiday had been just a few episodes later and Jean-Luc had gotten Vash pregnant on Ryza?
Oh, man.
Because you know that, I mean, if Jack and Vash were running around, the Borg would have found them quickly, no problem.
I mean, the Star Trek galaxy would have been over, you know, years ago, if that had been the case. So,
although maybe Q would have intervened on Vash's behalf, maybe.
Possibly. You know, I think, though, the interesting part of this is then the way in which, you know, Geordi even says it. They were able to assimilate the entire fleet without even us knowing it. And then, two, by placing these changelings and replacing certain people in Starfleet, they've been able to enact this plan then as well to be able to take over the fleet so that everything comes together here because they were able to finally find Jack. And again, I think this is so interesting the way in which we're talking about the ideas of, you know, changing people's DNA so that then they can be receivers for this, which also makes sense. Then as you rewatch the series, you're like, oh, that's why Jack can control certain people, is because you notice all the people he can control are younger. And it also made sense. I was like thinking to myself, oh, last episode, she shot Tavreen. Well, Tavreen is a Vulcan, which means she's probably well over the age of, you know, so like all these things begin to make sense. And so I really enjoyed that aspect of way a lot of things started to fall into place.
Yeah. Now that's a really good point. I actually didn't think about it until you said it. But yeah, the fact that she has, we're talking about Vadic here, has the phaser to the back of the head of Esmar, but then shoots Tavreen. She's never going to kill Esmar or the Bajoran guy whose name is Matthew, I think, actually.
Yeah, Matthew Murrah. Yeah.
She wasn't going to kill them because she knew the plan, right?
Yeah.
So they were safe the whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think I love all of that. And what, you know, what's actually kind of interesting too, is that, you know, with Jack being the key and the combination of the fleet integration, apparently the Borg have just been sitting back and watching BSG. You know, they realized the Cylon plan was actually a really good plan. And so,
well, actually, Matthew, they're not the only ones who have been sitting back and watching BSG. Geordi also has, he has it on loop in the Fleet Museum.
That's true.
That's why the Enterprise D is not networked into the rest of the fleet.
Well, and it's why he's been writing all those nasty notes to Starfleet about why this is such a bad idea. And so, you know, I love the way in which the more that I've thought about it, the more the plan makes sense. And it's also interesting too. It's like all of the ways in which you have these renegade changelings who have been tortured by some part of Starfleet, most likely Section 31, and turned into these mutant changelings that are able to do what they're able to do. And then the Borg being able to utilize them for this plan. It also makes sense as to why the face had such disdain for them.
Yeah.
And called them not as unique as you think you are, which is, you know, the Borg think of themselves as being perfect beings. And therefore, it would make sense why they would think that. And so I just, the more I've thought about it, the more I've really liked it. And, you know, I think that, for me, yes, I was frustrated with the thought of the Borg being back, but I think that the writers and Metallus here have been able to create something which is very interesting. And again, what I think is great is that it's an evolution of the Borg. We were kind of talking about this again on the other side of the Titan, this idea of that the Borg are moving even more towards a synthetic that feels more human, which, you know, in some ways I think is a real narrative about our world, right? The way the technology and the way in which humanity are coming closer and closer together in a way that it's hard to, you know, like when you have all these AI things and you've got all of the, you know, VR things and all of this stuff where we're becoming more and more alike. It makes sense why, you know, this version of the Borg look even more human than they ever did before, because technology and humanity, it's almost indistinguishable now.
Yeah, it's interesting how the world has changed since the Borg first appeared, because originally the Borg were more of a warning about the dangers of allowing technology to become part of us and using synthetic organs, using just allowing technology to merge with us and the dangers of technology to who we are. And now that 30 something years have passed, we're seeing the Borg being presented almost in the reverse way, like you're describing there. And I was wondering, as I was watching this, if we're seeing the Borg seeking to evolve in some way, because the fact that they created a biological technology in the first place that they implanted in Jean-Luc, whereas normally what they do is they would assimilate biological life forms and then inject the nanoprobes and then fit them with all sorts of mechanical attachments, arms, eyes, and so forth to become more technological. And then here, when Jack is talking to Jean-Luc, he makes one comment, which I really hope is answered in the final episode, and I think would make the story far more interesting than how it appears initially. He tells Jean-Luc, the Borg, they don't feel, don't care, but I do. So how does that factor into this?
Yeah.
And when he said that, I felt like the Borg have some sort of plan, that this isn't just a plan to destroy the Federation, but that there's something else that the Borg sure. have in mind for themselves, where they have reached a point where they want to have a connection to the world around them in a way that they haven't had in the past, where they've been like these zombies. Like, they actually want to feel and experience in a different way, and that this biological technology could in part be a long-term plan to get there, but it's something they couldn't do on their own. They actually needed a human, or doesn't necessarily have to be human, but a human to incubate this technology in some way so they could eventually reap the benefits of it.
I think that that's actually going to be one of the keys to defeating the Borg, is that their key is Jack. And Geordi makes a comment about how he may be Borg, but that's not all he is.
Right.
And so I actually think that's going to be a key, because what Jack desires to have humanity be able to listen to one another and mm-hmm. understand one another and to be able to find a way to find unity and come together. Well, the unity that we have in Star Trek and we've always seen is that infinite diversity and infinite combinations, right? It's not about oneness or groupthink. It's about this idea of combining the best of all worlds, right? And in some ways, this gigantic melting pot of people and ideas to which create something new and beautiful. And that's the very antithesis to the Borg. And so I still think that that's going to be, I think that's actually going to be their Achilles heel. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very interested to see in the way in which, yes, they've put all of their chips in Jack, and that may be their undoing as well. And mm-hmm. so, because to me, I think that there's also one of the things that really actually made me connect with this Borg story was the fact that this story seems to be a warning to the idea of being over-connected. There's a healthy form of this and there's an unhealthy form of this. And the Borg's version, as Jack calls it, a version of connection, is cybernetic authoritarianism. It's that forced unity, which is unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And I think there is such a fantastic theme about being too connected, too networked. And I think for me, that was really playing out. And it's clear here that one of the themes is we see it in our world. Our younger generations are so plugged in and so connected that it's creating this very dangerous hive mind and the kind of groupthink mm-hmm. and digital authoritarianism, which is making its way into the real world. And so I think that is a clear theme to me in this season about the danger of forced unity. Mm-hmm. And I thought that I was actually very surprised to see this as a theme in the season, because it's very countercultural in some ways to mm-hmm. talk about these ideas like this. But also I would say it's classically liberal in the sense of Star Trek has always been about the beauty of the individual and those individuals working together as a whole. And so, you know, the yeah. Borg being the evil version of that.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful point. And I think that, yeah, it's very true that technology in our own world today, social media is really driving it, is creating a sort of hive mind. And it is creating a, as you phrased it there, a digital authoritarianism in a sense, where if you don't agree with the group, then you are
exactly.
cast out because you don't agree, which is counter to what Star Trek is supposed to be about with IDIC, with infinite diversity in infinite combinations, and the fact that we're stronger together, the Federation, we're stronger together because of our differences, not because we're all alike and not
yes.
because we all think the same thing. We
exactly.
find a way to take different thoughts and find the best in them and improve ourselves in that way. And now that I use that term or that phrase, improve ourselves, it also reminds me of what the Borg have always said. They seek to improve themselves by assimilating other cultures.
Right. But
whereas
they then
the
subjugate those cultures in
right,
a way that
subjugate,
crushes
right.
out all of the ingenuity
yeah.
and
yeah.
identity to them. So they yeah. lose all that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And whereas the Federation is seeking to be stronger through diversity and through different views and thoughts and experiences
mm-hmm.
and
right.
ideas. When Jack says the line that you mentioned earlier about how he always wished the people could hear each other and see each other and connect and so forth, what I found interesting about that line is that it felt a bit like Jack saying that he's always felt that way and maybe he doesn't know why. And then he says, who knew a little cybernetic authoritarianism was the answer.
Right.
And then he's realizing, oh, I have this Borg connection, so maybe that's where that comes
mm-hmm.
from. But the ultimate desire that he feels is something that would be very beneficial if it can be done in a healthy way.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting too, because I was seeing the way in which this theme had been playing out all season. And in many ways, I feel like Shaw and Seven actually represent kind of the good tension that's needed in the healthy society of connection,
mm-hmm.
which is you've got the maverick and you've got the rule follower and you need both,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they work
yeah.
as checks and balances towards one another. And the mm-hmm. Borg, you know, the queen says that we're like shattered glass, but that's actually how we're at our best is when we have those effective checks and balances to our system and ourselves. And that's actually, I think, when things begin to crumble in that, when we begin to lose those checks and balances towards each other, and we do, like you were talking about, where it becomes about persecuting those who don't think like the group, and mob rule mm-hmm. becomes the accepted form of society, that's when we're at our worst. And the best mm-hmm. way, I think, to be able to keep that from happening as well, this whole season is about family, right? And why it's important. And the beauty of families is that they're made up of people who are of different ages, right? Who learn to work to solve problems. And they have the combination then of tradition, what came before, and ingenuity, which is what helps like further invention. And so this does mean then, and I think this is another beauty of this season, it's saying that wisdom from years of lived experience is actually really important. The wisdom of the ages
yeah.
is actually better sometimes than the fresh and the new, because they
mm-hmm.
have to counteract each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
you need both.
Right, exactly. No, and I'm not saying that you don't, but it's
mm-hmm.
the idea that time-tested and true ideas are better. And so all ideas then need to be come time tested to see whether they last. And
yeah.
it is that combination of the two which make a very
mm-hmm.
a healthy society.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would just change one word there. The tried and true ideas are not necessarily better, but they're reliable, and society needs that to function properly. And the new ideas may be better than the ones that we've been relying on for a long time, but those ideas need to be given time to evolve, and we find out if they're better ideas or not.
Yeah.
We don't just cast aside the old ones or the existing ones,
right?
Because we think they're old and stodgy.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, there's a, you know, there's a,
you remember the whole boomer thing from a few years ago, right? So
there's a Bible verse that says something along the nature of to not be tossed around by every wave of doctrine. So the idea that you need to test things, right? That we're not just thrown around by every new idea that's come, but that idea is tested against what we know. And then it's tested to see whether, like you were saying, is it actually better? And if it is, then we accept that, right? But it's because that we've gone through the process of testing it against what we know. And so, again, to me, there was such a beauty in this too, because I really felt like the season, the themes came into focus all together here in a way that was very much speaking to the world that we live in. And and what's interesting is that it feels as timeless too as something like The Lessons of 1984. And I was not expecting that in this season, but I was really thankful that this season was willing to, I think, say something that's very, very important and is definitely a warning to us all.
And like you have said, a little bit counter to what you might expect in modern Star Trek in terms of the message and it being a bit more, I guess, timeless, diverse. I don't know. It's a little bit more, well, it takes me back to the DS9 stuff that we always talk about. It's really doing what great science fiction does, whether it's on television or it's in novels or short stories or on film.
Right.
Where it takes a look at a social issue and it really delves into it, and it does it in a way that is palatable to people because it's couched in something, in this case, the Borg, something that Star Trek fans love for the most part. And it's a story that on the surface, the first time you watch through what's happening in this episode, you feel a little bit like been there, done that. But if you think about it and you start digging into it, you can see the nuance in here and how it's relevant to our world today, even though the Borg have been around for so long now in Star Trek. And even longer outside Star Trek, because, you know, they're really old.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this is why the ideas of, like you were talking about, these timeless ideas, and one of the reasons that Deep Space Nine is something that we've had so much fun continuing to talk about for so many years is because of the depth that's there. And I think it's very similar to the reasons which the best of Star Wars has stuck around as well, because of those timeless ideas, you know, especially when you think about what George Lucas was doing with the prequel trilogy, which was, okay, how does a society move from something that's like a republic or is a republic towards an authoritarian government? And so those ideas of how that happens are very similar in many ways to kind of what's happening here, how you move from a society which embraces individuality for the greater good, right, towards a groupthink digital authoritarianism, you know, and that's that's an incredibly poignant and prescient theme for now, but also for all time, right? This is not a theme that's going to go away, because this is not going to be something that humanity is not going to continue to struggle with.
Yeah, exactly, because if we cycle through what's happening in the world right now and go back to something that is a little bit less, a little bit further away from the groupthink that we are falling into, eventually we're going to fall back into it again. It's cyclical. That's the nature of societies and life. One thing I want to also talk about while we're still on the topic of the Borg here, is I just want to hear your thoughts on the Borg-Changeling collaboration. Because one thing the Borg Queen says to Jack, she says, "What I see in you, what Vadik saw, is an end, the vindication of both our species, to take everything back from those who live like shattered glass," which you mentioned the shattered glass earlier. But I'm trying to wrap my head around the collaboration that's going on. You know, Beverly says that clearly the Borg and the changelings have been working together from the start. Now, what that means, I'm not sure, because initially I took it to mean all the way back to the point at which the Borg planted the seed in Jean-Luc's parietal lobe. But that doesn't make sense on the timeline, because we don't even encounter changelings until sometime after that.
Right.
And while the Borg and the changelings may have encountered each other, perhaps they wouldn't have had a shared hatred of the Federation or a desire to destroy Starfleet at that point, because the Dominion War hadn't happened yet. So maybe she means from the start of what you said earlier in our discussion, the discovery that Jack exists, and then they start looking for him, and the Borg hire this group of changelings to go try to find him and bring him back. But even then, I have the question of how do the Borg and the changelings get mixed up with each other in the first place?
Yeah, I guess I don't really have as big of an issue with this. It's like, yeah, it just happened. I don't know. It's one of those things which I'm willing to allow the story to be told without having to have all of the details. Mm-hmm. Part of this, too, I think when we say changelings, we have to be really careful, too. We're not talking about the Great Link. We're talking about these renegade changelings. So that's very different, right? When they came into being in the first place, it seems from the story we got to be more recent, you know, so maybe within the last few years, their existence, you know, they seem to have been tested on for we don't know how long. And so their involvement with the Borg here, you know, I'm just headcanoning this, but to me, the Borg somehow realized that Jack exists within the last year or two. And they need a way to find him, one, and two, they do have this way to be able to infiltrate all of Starfleet through what they had implanted in Jean-Luc's body. Now, again, that's thrown into whack, too, because, you know, Jean-Luc himself doesn't exist the way he used to. And so they need changelings. They need somebody who can infiltrate in the way that's possible. And just so happens, Starfleet, stupidly, was playing around with changelings and created changelings that could infiltrate Starfleet in a way that could almost undetectable. And so what's, again, we even talked about this before. This speaks to the idea of humanity playing around with things and causing our own destruction by playing around with things we shouldn't be playing around with, whether it's
like ChatGPT.
by trying to make viruses more virulent, you know, right? Like, this is the lesson that we're learning here. And so those are just kind of like all the things that would have had to happen to put the connections together. But you know, if they have been working on this for any time within the last, I don't know. But that those are kind of like, okay, I can let this all play out. And me, you know, I don't have all the answers as to how they all got connected, but I can quickly in my head start to be able to construct ways in which that happens, which, I don't know. We were even talking about last time. It's like, I don't need them to tell me everything.
Yeah, so, sure. Yeah,
but
yeah. I guess for me, it would make the story more interesting to have the changeling texture to what's going on, so that it's not just a Borg story, and that the changelings weren't just there because it gives us that DS9 connection as well. Right. I mean, that's not the only reason, because obviously their shape-shifting abilities allowed them to infiltrate Starfleet in a way right. that the Borg couldn't do, and in a way that's completely critical to having this plan work. Mm-hmm. So it feels like there's a lot of... I can just picture the Borg and the Changeling sitting around a conference table in a dark room working out all the details of this, I guess. You know, it's like,
that's funny.
Speaking of which, because I'll forget later, didn't you love the fact that for one last time, Geordi and Data got to give a PowerPoint presentation?
Yeah.
Like they great. Always did on The Next Generation when yep. they explained Borg DNA to Beverly.
You know, I think another place, though, where... To me, you know, you mentioned the idea, okay, I don't want this to just be another story of, you know, the Borg. You were asking for there to be more of a connection, you know, between the two mm-hmm. working together. But I think also another thing that in some ways is interesting to me is the idea that there are so many times, especially in our world, right, where people are working towards a goal with a greater entity, person, mm-hmm. Government or whatever. And what they don't realize is they're just being used. Mm-hmm. And yeah. in many ways, you know, the Borg Queen here is like Palpatine in Star Wars. She'll use anyone and everyone to get what she wants. And I feel mm-hmm. like the sad part about this story is actually these changelings have been misused and abused by Section 31. And now they've been used and abused by the Borg. Mm-hmm. And in the end, nobody cares about them, right? And so I think that's something that's really interesting.
Yeah,
now, we do
yeah.
know from the story that Worf was told by Odo that there was a renegade group of changelings. Mm-hmm. And he's been researching this, but we don't know for how long. And Ro has as well. So again, there is an indication that there have been rumblings about this for some time. We just don't know how long the time is, but it's been, my guess is, at least a year, if not more. Oh, yeah. So that this has been,
I feel
kind
like it's
of,
more
yeah,
yeah,
going on.
Because so. The networking of all the starships in the fleet feels very much like a Borg thing. And so it feels like an idea that the Borg would want to do more so than Starfleet would want to do, and that the plan was carried out over time by Starfleet leaders within Starfleet who were actually changelings.
Exactly.
That Starfleet had been infiltrated at its highest levels, and those changelings posing as Starfleet officers over time had instituted this networking of the starships and this fleet formation technology.
Yes.
And if that's the case, and then there's also the idea, this could be done in a much shorter time frame, but there's this idea of spreading changelings mm-hmm. to different starships sure. so that they could get Jean-Luc's biological signatures into the transporter system so that they mm-hmm. could slowly assimilate. And, you know, Geordi says that they've been assimilating the fleet this whole time.
Right.
And again, we're not given a time frame for that, but just the way it's discussed and everything that we're seeing feels like it's something that happened over the course right. of at least a few years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not like a few months, not a year, but a little mm-hmm. bit longer than that. It just seems like such a big operation.
Yeah,
that it would take time to carry it out.
And we absolutely, I think, could say, I don't think there's been anything in this season that would take away from the idea that the changelings and the Borg have been working towards this mm-hmm. for maybe all of Star Trek Picard that we have seen. And therefore, that's still a possibility, I think, of being able to say that they might not have had every single piece that gets into the plan as we have it now, But the idea of trying to, you know, take over Starfleet in the way that they have just within the fleet operations, all that would still work, right? All of that would still allow them to be able to take over very quickly all of Starfleet, even if they weren't able to assimilate everyone, right? And so I think there's just so much here that really allows us to be able to then, as we kind of talked about, go back and see connections and the whole series, and maybe even especially making season one better in that sense with the attitudes we saw of the Federation and them dealing with the Romulan supernova and everything, all the attitudes that had happened there. And so, like, yeah, I think that that's all still pretty open. And that's actually pretty exciting for this as well. So, yeah.
Well, I think for sure it could stretch back to the beginning of the Star Trek Picard series in terms of the timeline. I personally feel like it probably stretches back further. Another thing that Shelby says that made me think that is when she talks about fleet formation, she says that it's unity and defense.
Yeah.
And the fact that she uses the word unity made it feel to me like it's an idea that was initially planted by changelings sent by the Borg to carry out a Borg plan, because of course humans could use the word unity and all, but it just felt that way. Like, it felt odd. And then she says that it's for the ultimate safeguard. And later she does say that it will protect our crews in our continued exploration of what still remains our final frontier. But overall, at this point, like, the feeling I get looking at Starfleet and all those ships and everything is that it feels like it's shifting too much towards a military organization as opposed to an exploratory organization, which is what Starfleet is. We can have the debate, and we've had it on other podcasts. It's a little bit of both, but at its core, Star Trek was about exploration.
Well, I think that one of the beauties of having Shelby be responsible for this is the way in which throughout history, we have seen people who have been staunchly against something slowly make their way to another side of the issue. And then be championing ideas to which you would have thought anathema to them years before. And people can do that for political reasons or because they genuinely have a change of heart. And so I think that is actually interesting. And it's something that I wish almost that the episode had just a little bit more time to explore, because it is an interesting idea. But I think, again, by using a Shelby for this, you know, Picard even points out it's so odd that she would be so in favor of something that's so Borg-like, you know, Shelby. And I think that's kind of the point, right? Because and that's, I think, an incredibly important theme, which is that, you know, all of a sudden, if somebody just flip-flops on an idea, or we see that, it's like, what in the world changed in that person for them to go from saying one thing and saying they believe one thing to being completely different? Like, what is that? And
but of course, in her case, she didn't necessarily, we don't know, but she didn't necessarily suddenly flip-flop, right? This could have been a very gradual process for her over like 30 years.
Right.
Where she came to see the value in something that if she really thought about it, she would realize, wow, this is like the Borg.
Yeah, exactly.
But it just kind of creeps up on you over time and you don't realize how close you've moved to that thing that you were once against.
Exactly.
Now, about Shelby being the fleet admiral, I did notice a few people say that that should have been Janeway as the fleet admiral. And I had a similar thought, but a big reason it couldn't be Janeway is that Shelby gets killed, right? Can you imagine if they had killed Janeway in that scene and what fans would have felt like?
Well, and I don't think that Janeway would have ever been and
susceptible to this idea.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, exactly. And so therefore, you needed a character who's somewhat recognizable. And, you know, I think...
And has a connection to the Borg.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, them being won over to this argument, I think, made people feel at ease with doing it within Starfleet, because, again, it's Shelby. And so, you know, if you can get somebody like that to your side, it alleviates a lot of people's fears, right? And so, therefore, it makes that important.
And the ambition that we see from her in The Best of Both Worlds, where she's gunning for Riker's role on the Enterprise, that ambition makes it completely plausible that she could rise to become Fleet Admiral.
Yes. Well, and I think it also, that ambition could lead her to being susceptible to changing her views to be able to get into power. So that's another, I think, a great way of looking at this, too. So I got to ask you, Chris, because, you know, we've talked, of course, throughout the season about the character of Shaw. And, you know... unfortunately, Shaw makes the ultimate sacrifice in this episode
Does he?
I believe he does. You know, Metalis even said that the end for Shaw was always to have him die at the hands of the Borg, but to have come through this metamorphosis of this person who, you know, had this hatred and he was taking it out on Seven and all. So...
But Metalis has also said that it's always been the plan for Shaw to be part of the spinoff series.
Yes. So how that works, I don't necessarily understand. So we'll see.
Nanoprobes.
Yeah, could be. And it could be one of those.
He'll be one of the new evolved Borg once the biological technology is fully integrated.
Well, and I was thinking, too, that it could absolutely be that, he died. But we've also seen people die on Star Trek before and be able to be brought back to life through various means, right? That absolutely could happen, and it still doesn't cheat his arc. But I thought that this was great because the previous episode, they have the confrontation on the bridge, and she says, "My name is Seven of Nine." And so when he is dying and he says, "The Khan is yours, Seven of Nine." And it was a really beautiful moment. And I think it was really well done. I think, again, the beauty of creating a character like this is you get to take them on this journey, which makes us fall in love with them. And then they do that thing to which they would have never done before, which is make that ultimate sacrifice for somebody that they kind of hated in the beginning. And I think there's a real
beauty. Or they resented anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a real beauty to that because, again, there's nothing that says that you love a person more than you're willing to lay your life down for them. And in the end, Shaw shows himself to be a man who is willing and capable of admitting his mistakes and putting his life on the line for his crew in the same way that Seven was willing to do in the previous episode, which is what we see in the best captains. So I loved it.
I had a little bit of a, well, what you described there, yes, completely on board with that. And I was looking for what is the redemption arc for him. And I wasn't sure that I thought he was going to die. I think I may have said last episode or the one before that I thought that he might come around at the end after he sees that breaking the rules helps them to save everyone. But the fact that he was killed here and what he says to Seven of Nine, I thought worked really well. I did feel a little bit, especially the first time watching it, that it was kind of rushed. It was just... I felt like he deserved a little bit more of a moment, but I mixed on that because on the one hand, as a viewer watching a television show and thinking about the creative aspect of writing and putting it together, the show, maybe I would want them to give him a little bit more time. But on the other hand, in real life, people suddenly die, and in that situation that they're in right there, absolutely it could happen that quickly and it's over, and then Seven has to move on, right? So I think it worked fine for me, even though I think a lot of viewers probably feel like it was a little bit rushed and a little bit, okay, now we've just got the TNG cast to focus on for the finale.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the beautiful thing here is too, right? He's sacrificing himself so that they can hopefully stop the Borg once and for all. Mm-hmm. The person that had made his life a living hell, that had turned, he had allowed them to turn him into a person he did not recognize. Mm-hmm. And that here, it's almost as if, you know, we've been talking about this whole idea of will there be a turn? Will there be a shift in the relationship between him and Seven? What's going to happen? And I think this signifies that shift has happened, right? He's always going to have a unique way of being, you know, he's not going to stop being Shaw, but that, mm-hmm. that there is something that has changed in him, and that, of course, if we did see him in a Star Trek Legacy series, and mm-hmm. they do give us that series, which you are fools if you do not, so do it. But so if he is there, yes, there we are going to see somebody who's different, mm-hmm. and I think that that's great. And again, too, I'm reminded this isn't his show. This is Picard. And so he is tangential to everything that's happening with them.
Yeah. One more little element of his redemption arc there that I think probably goes unnoticed is the fact that he has all this animosity towards the Borg. He talked about Wolf 359. He talked about Locutus. He wouldn't let Seven use her name. And when they're fleeing the bridge, he actually orders phasers to be on stun only.
Yes.
They shoot the crew members who had been assimilated. And that's something where I'm not sure that a younger, by younger, I mean maybe months younger, actually before the story started, Shaw would have necessarily done when confronted with Borg, but he realizes at that moment that these are still his people, even though they've been assimilated. And rather than kill them, he just wants to stun them and get away.
Well, and I think, that's something that Picard didn't do, you know, right? And mm-hmm. Picard himself said, you know, shoot them, you'll be doing them a favor. I think
in First Contact, right?
Yeah. So there's a difference there, and mm-hmm. I think that's a good difference to see.
That could stem, however, from Jean-Luc's personal experience having been a Borg and knowing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 100%.
Borg themselves would have no mercy on anyone.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think that there's that difference there, and it makes it a good story point. And so I'm glad that they did that. And so I guess, Chris, we got to talk about the big D in the room. Yes, of course, in Bay 12, as we all knew it was going to be, was Big D. She's back and looking pretty good for a starship that was crashed and that, you know, basically Geordi has been putting back together in his spare time, kind of like somebody with a, classic car. And
Well, it reminded me, actually, my dad spent years restoring his old car from high school, an old Pontiac GTO that my grandmother had driven for years. And then when she couldn't drive anymore, he got it back and then he had it parked. And like Geordi was doing with the D, he's just slowly over the years restoring it.
Well, and, you know, of course, they couldn't use the Enterprise E, because...
Well, that was not Worf's fault, Matthew.
Which if they don't write a book about that, I'm going to be so mad.
By the way, so that line is hilarious and Michael Dorn's delivery of it is absolutely fantastic, but... Go back and watch that scene many times and watch the faces of everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody plays that scene, especially Riker and Geordi. Oh, it's the little smirks, the little glares, yes. little I really want to know what happened.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And so I think, you know, I love that Picard likes the carpet. Because you know, it's got to feel nicer on your feet than just those hard floors and all the starships now. So yeah,
well, and you know, Geordi's had it cleaned as well, so it's probably a lot more sanitary than it was when they were coming back from away missions all the time.
exactly. And I was slightly disappointed, and I get why they did it, but I was slightly disappointed that this was not the bridge from Generations, because that bridge is much more cinematic.
They had to do the TV one. Yeah, I know.
It, you know, what's fascinating too is you just see how design changes. And of course, because we all have 16:9 televisions now instead of 4:3s, this bridge completely, and even the Enterprise D itself, the way it's just this weird squat yet, I don't know, oblong. Everything about it just fits more within a 4:3 television than the new ships do. But obviously the loving care that they went into to do this was great. And of course, it brings everything full circle. And, you know, I'm really glad they did this. And of course, you know, Geordi says this is the only ship that exists now, which is outside the digital network of the fleet. This is quote unquote analog, even though that's probably really not the right term. No. But basically, you know, this is the Battlestar Galactica where it's not interconnected with the rest of the fleet. And I thought this was, you know, this was great. And it just reminds me that I've never been a huge fan of the D, but man, the F is so fugly that I hope that ship gets destroyed by the D in this episode or in the next episode. That would be great.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the F was originally created for Star Trek Online, right? So I think it looks better in a video game, I think, than it would as the hero ship of a TV series. But I can also see the, if I'm Starfleet and I'm designing a new class of ship and I want it to be very grandiose and I'm going to name it after the most historic ship, it's Odyssey class. But if that's the class that I'm going to use for the Grand Ole Enterprise, I don't know. I can see engineers making this kind of design, but it's certainly probably my least favorite Enterprise that I've seen.
Yeah.
Except maybe the J. The J is pretty weird.
Yeah. But I've always, the F I've just never liked. And so I've got a question.
Let me ask you though, while we're talking about the Enterprise F here though, and I mentioned that it was created for Star Trek Online. This whole scene of space dock and the fireworks in space and the Enterprise F leaving and so forth, did that feel a little bit too much like a video game to you compared with the visual effects that we're otherwise getting?
I mean, I was okay. I think it felt decently consistent with what we've gotten before. I think that, you know, the idea of fireworks in space and everything is very much a sci-fi, a weird thing anyway. And so
for me, it's less about the fireworks though. It's about the ship itself. I don't know. It felt more, you know, CGI these days is incredible in what they can do with the realism. This one felt a little bit more CGI to me.
I can see that. And I'm guessing that it has to do with the fact that there's so much going on in all of those scenes. You know, the work that they're putting into that is crazy. And
yeah,
so I do agree with you, though. It's fine, but it's not the best scene that we've seen.
Oh, yeah, it's fine. But I can imagine that maybe with a bigger budget and more time, more resources, they could make that feel more realistic than it felt to me.
So I'm interested, though, because Data tells Geordi, you know, you can't go after your daughters now. We need a plan. Well, they have the Enterprise D, but they immediately warp back to Earth. And so what's the plan here?
Well, I think you've mentioned part of it earlier in our discussion, which is that Jack is going to be part of what gets them out of this, his ability to feel and care, is probably going to, I don't know, for lack of a better word, short circuit the Borg Queen in some way. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What I hope they don't do, but I think could end up happening, is that it could be a repeat of The Best of Both Worlds, where they're able to put the collective to sleep again and then destroy the Borg cube and free the rest of the ships. What I don't think is going to happen is they're not going to destroy all the Starfleet ships, because you can't destroy your entire fleet. So they're going to have to get out of it in some way that frees the ships from this fleet formation mode, that brings back the assimilated youngsters from the ships. I don't think they're going to kill Sidney and Alondra.
Right. Oh, of course not. Yeah.
Jack may die. And in some ways, I think that would be very powerful for the story if Jack has to sacrifice himself and Jean-Luc and Beverly have to sacrifice their son to save everyone. I don't think that the LaForges are going to die. And I don't think that Esmar and Matthew and these other young characters who we've gotten to know, I don't think they're all going to die. I think they're going to somehow be returned to their normal state. And so how they go about doing that, I don't know, but it has to be a solution that is not the result of some kind of massive battle where dozens or hundreds of ships are destroyed. So I don't know. I don't think the Enterprise D is going to go flying in there with guns ablaze or anything like that.
Yeah, I think that, and my guess is that what is going to happen is that, like you said, you know, Jack is going to be the key to this. I also think that Beverly is going to be the key in helping come up with a solution that takes all of the information that we have right now and allows us to create the antidote to what the Borg have done to everyone.
I think there could be something in her talking about ants and bees and birds and
exactly
and how some transmitters and receivers are biological. In the moment, it seems like she's just talking about what's happening with Jack, but that also could be a clue to the solution that she's going to find for and how they actually send a command into the collective.
Well, and if Jack is the transmitter that is connected then and sends out the signal to everyone to be able to be Borgified, then you can absolutely reverse that process the same way. And so I 100% think that that's going to be part of the solution. And of course, I think Beverly will be a big part of that as well, and coming up with that with the help of, you know, Data and Geordi and everyone else. And so, yeah, I hope that Jack does not die. I think, you know, because I would like to see him in Star Trek Legacy series. I think that would be really interesting. And I say that because, you know, all the way back in one of the previous episodes, you know, he and Picard have the conversation about him joining Starfleet. And he's basically like, oh, hell no. You know, you don't know me at all. And so I think it would be an interesting arc for him to come around to that.
Yeah. And he's an interesting character, and Ed Spielers does such a great job acting. I mean, he should be nominated for awards for his performance in the season, I think.
Oh, I think it's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's 100. Yeah. I'm right there with you. You know, and I think that too, that you've created this tension with the fact that Rafi and Seven are, you know, with Shaw's body on the Titan. And so this has to be a quick solution. This can't take forever because they're not going to be able to last on the Titan without some sort of intervention quickly. I also think, you know, I'm predicting that by the end of the episode, you know, Janeway shows up at the end to hand the keys to the Titan to Seven to be the captain, and Tuvok will be there as well.
Well, Tuvok has to be there because
Yes, Tim Russ already said
said he's in two episodes, and so far he's been in one. So, but do you think that they will get Janeway?
100% I mean, there's no way. I would put money on the fact that, that she will show up. Now, I don't believe she's going to show up to solve any problems, but I think she will be there again to hand the keys to
She'll
Seven.
She'll just be there at the end.
Exactly.
And I think that compared with some of the other people we've said that we wish they could have looped in the story somehow, like Avery Brooks as Sisko, or bring Shatner back for a final appearance of Kirk, or having Bashir. Janeway, I think, because of Kate Mulgrew's current involvement in the franchise
through
Prodigy, makes that far, far more likely that they will be able to bring her in for something like that.
Yeah. I could suspect her being a part of a Titan series in the sense of, like, she makes cameos in certain episodes as an admiral. Or maybe
it's like Charlie's Angels and we just hear her voice through a little box on Seven's desk in her ready room.
Could be. I like the way that this this penultimate episode has set us up for the finale. And I think for all of our trepidation and mine specifically about this being the Borg, I think that, again, the more I've watched the episode and the more I've thought about the way things fit together, I think that the storytellers here, Metallus specifically, coming up with this idea, has crafted a fitting end for the next generation. And that's what he was trying to do. That was the goal here, was to give them the send-off that Nemesis wasn't. And I think this creates that send-off. And I think it actually makes a nice... when I think about it, almost duology with First Contact, right? And the Best of Both Worlds. You have this really interesting trilogy of stories that kind of the beginning, middle, and end of this story. And so I like that as well. And I appreciate that, please God, let this be the end of the Borg, in the sense of, I would be upset that, you know, the only reason to do this story is for that. So that's where I come full circle of our conversation. Like, it needs to be the end.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about, I think it was last time, the mention that in the first few episodes, there are various clues that you don't pay much attention to the first time through, but they are cluing you into what's going to happen. Now, of course, as it turns out, the whole thing with Picard's log about the Borg playing at the very, very beginning.
Right, like exactly.
First scene of the series. That was a clue. Yep. But the other one that I remember that you and I talked about in the first episode of The Artificial Tango for season 3, I asked about the theme. Like, do you think they're going to use the First Contact theme music throughout, or is it just here opening it up? But it turns out that actually the theme music is a clue. Right.
Exactly.
Because it's the First Contact theme music.
Well, and it's interesting too, because one of the clues throughout all of this, and one of the ways in which Jack has been able to resist what's happened for so long to him, was what his mother shared with him, which was Picard's mixtape. And that music is playing for him when he remembers the memories of going to the Arboretum with his mother, a place that he felt safe and the beauty, you know, struck him and everything. So again, there's so many different little connections that have been interwoven into every single part of this series, so that we're interweaving the nostalgia with the storytelling to help bring to a conclusion these characters that we've been staying time with for what, almost 40 years now. I mean, so it's crazy. And, you know, I think that they've done a really good job, which I, you know, in all honesty, I'm kind of wondering where you fall then with a rating for this episode.
Well, before I give you my rating, I just want to say that what you said right there in this episode, Jean-Luc tells Beverly, he inherited the best of you and the worst of me. But what he's forgetting is that he also inherited Picard's romantic mixtape. And that is not one of the worst things of Jean-Luc, apparently.
Yeah. Well, and he also, I mean, he inherited a lot of things from Picard that, you know, he's only begun to realize now, which I think will play into where we go in the final episode.
Yeah, yeah. And the one other thing I wanted to mention is that while it was not made clear, if you remember on our last discussion, I speculated that the Borg Queen had possessed Vadic's body, and it was actually the Borg Queen that was talking to Jack. And I still think that is the case because of the things like calling him baby boy. And then what we see in the discussion of the actual Borg Queen and him here, it did feel a bit like that is probably what was going on, but it's not, you know, confirmed. So, all right. Well, yeah, for a rating, I think that I'll give this episode 9 fireworks in space because, you know, it's an explosive rating. It's somewhat exciting. And I think the episode was all those things.
Yeah. You know, I think when I first thought about a rating for this, I'd kind of been around a 7. And part of that was my reaction.
On my first viewing, I think so, because you remember I texted you. I'm like, yeah. I watched the episode, and yeah.
And so I feel in many ways, you know, this is episodes 9 and 10 are the finale. And so we've only seen half the finale, really. Right. And therefore, I would give this 8 out of 10 Borg transmitters. You know, I think it's the more I've sat with it, the more I've thought with it, the better this episode has gotten. So, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting for the finale now, and I can't wait to see how the series and these characters wrap up.
Well, Matthew, you know what's great about your rating compared to mine? Mine just explodes and it's gone, but yours is constantly transmitting, so it will be received by other civilizations for as long as those transmitters are online.
Ah, well, that's a good idea.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Vox, the voice, not the one who speaks, but the voice. And there are many ways for you to share those thoughts with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. It is a closed group for that reason. So if you're joining for the first time, please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. We've been getting some great discussions going on there recently as the series comes to a conclusion, and we hope you'll join there. If you're looking for it, you're not yet a member, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come up. If not, type the whole name, the Babel Conference. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and your message will dance its way right over to Matthew and me. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is trekfm. And if you'd like to help us keep the final discussion of the artificial tango and everything we do in the future and all the shows on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. Become an associate producer. Help in other ways. It takes a great deal of money to produce and distribute these podcasts, and we would not be here without your help. So thank you so much to everyone who's supporting us right now. And also, if your app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not busy adding your own biology to the transporter systems, where can people find you?
Well, you could find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero are the places I am most active, so we'd love to interact with you there. Of course, I'm here on the network. On the other side of the network, we don't talk Star Trek, but we talk all of those other fandoms we love in the 602 Club. So please check that out. Follow us over there on social media as well under the 602 Club. You can also find me doing literary treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, you and I are doing the 30th anniversary rewatch for Star Trek Deep Space Nine on The Orb. We're doing the 20th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Enterprise on Warp 5. And Saddle Up is just right around the corner because Star Trek Strange New Worlds is coming back here in the summer. You'll also find me over on the Nerd Party Network. I've got a completed show called Owl Post with Drea Kaufman talking through every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week on Aggressive Negotiations. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out where you can get some Leola root that hasn't been infected by nanoprobes, where can people find you?
I think to do that, I've got to beam down to a planet with Neelix and dig around in dirt and possibly get taken captive by someone. So I got to be really careful about that, but it's worth it.
You definitely need to be careful.
It's worth it. I mean, there's nothing like fresh Leola root. That's delicious.
What I hear.
But when I'm not doing that, you can find me elsewhere on the network, as you mentioned, doing all those shows with you, Larry Nemechek, and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And you can find me in many episodes of many shows in the back catalog. You can also find me on social media if you'd like to chat about Star Trek or Japan or football or whatever you want to talk about. I'd love to talk to you there. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. Twitter is where I'm most active, but you can find me everywhere, and I'm also on Mastodon on the Trekkies.social instance, so please send me a message, and let's chat in social media. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next week for one more dance as we find out just what the last generation refers to.
Well, Chris, I can't wait for that, and the con is yours.